talking about the geometry of numbers.
Right. All right. So. All right. So, this is a topic, the geometry of numbers, that I learned about kind of recently, but there's no reason why I should have learned about it so late, because it's really simple. And it's a really, I think, a very beautiful subject. It's been around for a long time. So you guys, anyone ever heard of Minkowski before?
Minkowski.
No, it's okay.
The guy from Minkowski diagrams?
I don't know. Does someone know? I don't know what that is. Oh, wait. Like light cones and things like that?
Yeah.
Same guy. Yeah, so anyway, he basically is like the father of the geometry of numbers. We're not going to start off talking about numbers. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Make a few definitions. But this is actually some really simple but powerful tools that you find in algebraic number theory and other branches of mathematics to prove really cool things. So I'll show you, I won't really show you how to do this, but I'll show you that, you know, one of the things that we're going to prove today has a really cool corollary, which gives a lower bound for the discriminant of a number field, an algebraic number field. And I don't know if you guys are too familiar with that, so we'll go over a little bit about it. I'm definitely not very strong in algebraic number theory, but Keenan here will fix any mistake that I make, because he's the king, you know. So we're going to be proving today Minkowski's first theorem. So Minkowski's fundamental theorem in this subject, the geometry of numbers, is called the convex body theorem. And it's really cool. It has a cool name. So, but we're not going to use Minkowski's original proof. We're going to use a proof that uses Fourier analysis. We're going to prove it using Fourier series. Has anyone seen that before?
Yes.
So raise your hand if you've seen Fourier series before in your life. This is great. Okay, this is great, because then I won't feel so bad when I use them. All right. So a symmetric body. So symmetric body or a convex symmetric body. Symmetric body. So a symmetric body is going to be K in our talk today. It's going to be a subset of Rn. Okay. And it's going to have some properties. So one property is that K is symmetric. So what does this mean? This means that if X is in K, then minus X is in K. Okay. That's not the only property. I also want K to be convex. Has anyone ever seen the word convex before? Okay. Anyone know what this means? Just intuitively what convex means? What does it mean?
If you have any two points in your set, the line, or in a vector space, the line between them is also contained in that set.
Right. Exactly right. So if X and Y are in K, then the line connecting them is also. Another way you can write this in orange is lambda x plus 1 minus lambda y for lambda in 0 to 1. So the line connecting x to y can be written in this way. Okay. So let's see. So these are the main properties I want K to have. And then here are some kind of technical properties I want it to have. I want K to be bounded. So I don't want any tentacles going off to infinity. Okay. And I want it to be closed. And if you guys don't know what closed mean, don't worry about it. It just means that it's going to have its boundary. Like, I'm not putting a dotted line on the boundary. And I want it to have non-empty interior. And if you don't know what that means, Is interior just with one R right there?
Yeah.
Okay. So that means that I want to have... So I'm going to have some kind of thing. I don't know what it looks like yet. Non-empty interior, I basically want it to be non-trivial. I want it to be able to put a little ball around the origin. Okay. Otherwise, the stuff kind of breaks down. So this is what a symmetric body is. Okay. Anyone have an example? So I have some examples prepared, some symmetric bodies. But I think that if we work together, and I know that there's a lot of bright people in here, we could come up with a few examples of what is a symmetric body. So we want to satisfy these conditions. So example one. Yeah?
The closed unit ball.
The closed unit ball. And this is probably one of my favorite examples. So the closed unit ball, this is the points in Rn such that if I take the norm of x, then this is less than 1. This is the Euclidean norm, right? Anyone else have an example? Yeah.
A cube?
Yeah, a cube. Like a cube, right? So a cube. So maybe I'll say Q, because Q sounds like cube. So there are points in Rn such that, and I'll say that the entries of the specter are xi and so, you know what I mean? If you have a problem, just let me know. So then I'll say that I'm going to have, maybe I'll take the cube that goes from like this. Right? All right, does anyone have any other examples? These are very good ones. How about a star? Is a star a convex body? Like, what if I did something like the star, this star? Or is this a symmetric body?
Yeah.
No, I don't think it is. Yeah, so this fails kind of in a few different ways. So, first of all, if I try to connect these two points, I'm not going to be contained in there, right? Also, that's basically what fails, right? Is this symmetric? Yeah, it has a symmetry. Yeah, so this is not... So not everything's a convex body, right? Well, so I could also tilt these things around, right? I could rotate them and they'd still be convex bodies. Oh, wait. Is that true? Yeah, it is true, right? Okay. So, actually, I could write this another way. I don't know if you guys know this notation, but I'm going to write it anyway. Another way I could write this is that the infinity norm is less than 1. The infinity norm just means the supremum of all the entries. And this is actually a norm on Rn. So this is some abstract definition of norm. So you could actually show that any symmetric body is actually the unit ball of some norm on Rn. That's kind of cool, right? So all of these are the unit ball of some norm. That's kind of cool. So like when you said the unit ball, you didn't really specify like which norm you're talking about. But everyone knew what you're talking about, because whenever we say unit ball, everyone assumes we're talking about Euclidean distance or something, or the Euclidean norm. There's a lot of different kinds of norms out there. Like, one norm is given by this, and it's just the sum of the entries to the absolute value p, and like this. This is called, like, the LP norm, and it kind of looks kind of like some kind of weird distorted ball and everything. But what the cool thing is that every set like this is a unit ball for some norm. Okay? So I just like really said that like 10 times, so maybe we should move on. But I think it's cool. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Okay, so let's actually put these things inside of a picture, like inside of Euclidean space. Okay? So let's just talk about R2. That's the easiest vector space to draw for me, at least. So R2. And let's try to draw some of these things. So maybe I can... And didn't I say that any linear transformation of these things are also kind of like the same sort of object? One nice thing about a linear transformation is it takes convex sets to convex sets. Because it's linear, it will act on this linearly, right? And obviously, because of linearity, I'm going to have symmetry. Linear transformation since bounded sets, closed sets to closed sets. And Anyway, so I can take an ellipse. I can make a little ellipse, and that's kind of like a symmetric body, right? Like that. Or I could do the sphere, or the ball, like you guys said, or the cube, or something like that. So all ellipse, you know, any ellipse is really just a linear transformation of the unit ball, and maybe possibly like a transformation. Okay. So I'm going to draw lattice points. You guys know what lattice points are? They're the points in R2 that have only integer entries. So I'm going to try to draw a bunch of these. If it takes too long, hopefully it doesn't take the rest of my time because I have a lot to say. Okay. Okay. And then maybe I'll erase my ellipse. So I got a question. Can you guys tell me how to put a symmetric body on here so it doesn't contain a non-zero lattice point? So of course I'm going to have to contain this one. But will you guys tell me a symmetric body that doesn't contain any others? Shouldn't be too hard, because I haven't really put any restrictions on it. Just a very small ball, right? Okay. Maybe I should do a blue. Okay. No. Purple. No. Pink. Pink. Yeah, so this symmetric body does not contain any non-zero lattice points, right? And if I make it smaller, then the same thing's going to be true. But if I make it bigger, if I make it a lot bigger, it's going to, for this particular one, right? So if I try to make it really big, then all of a sudden I start to contain lattice points. This picture is not going the way I wanted it to, but you see what I'm saying. So if I kind of start dilating this set, then oops, I contain a lattice point. But what if I try to, you know, to distort it by a linear transformation, make it a little bit bigger, but then distort it by a linear transformation, like this? Then I'm, you know, I have made it bigger. Don't contain any lattice points there, right? So do you guys think that I could kind of always find like a big symmetric set and I could avoid lattice points altogether? Maybe. So what do you think the trick would be? Because like, if this is pointing too much towards this or one of the lattice points and I keep making it bigger, I'm going to run into a lattice point, right? So now I've kind of implicitly defined a problem for you, right? I've said, let's try to make a convex body that's kind of big, but it doesn't contain any non-zero lattice points. Oh, man. Oh, gosh. I wish I knew about this because this is useful. You know, taking this, you know, just knowing that you could actually find a convex body that would avoid all these things would, you know, imply a lot of really great things. And I only know that because it's not true, and then something that's not true implies everything that's kind of weird. Do you know what I mean? So it's actually not true. But so how would you guys try to start making a really, you know, a set with big area but misses lattice points? So you guys, yeah, what would you think you would try? Yeah, let's try it. Yeah, let's try it in an irrational line. So if I have an irrational line, or a line with a rational slope, like let's say this, and this is the slope's irrational here, this line never, ever hits a lattice point, does it? Because if it did, then you would have that, you know, y equals mx plus b, right? I think so, right? Y equals mx plus b, but b is 0, right? And if m is an irrational number, and this is an integer and that is an integer, oh my gosh. Oh no, right? Yeah, so if the slope's irrational, then I never hit a lattice point. I could try to thicken up the line a little bit, right? So this is, I think, your idea. So if you try to thicken up the line a little bit, then you get this convex body, right? It's kind of like this. And depending on how thick I want to make it, it changes what the volume is going to be, right? But you know, if you thicken this up enough, and you take the whole infinite line, if you kind of make this big enough, you're going to hit a lattice point, definitely, because you're gonna Because an irrational number can be very well approximated by rational numbers. This is something I really like about numbers. So now we have some kind of idea about how we can miss a lot of lattice points. But we know that, you know, if we make this, if you take your example and you thicken up the line and you just keep making the same thickening longer, you're going to contain a lattice point. So you'd have to kind of taper off somehow, right? But if you're going to taper off, the question is, like, how can you do it? So this is actually something that we can't, like, dismiss right away. You might be able to make a convex body so this kind of tapers off. And then, so it could be, like, maybe infinite and everything. But you can't do this. Okay? So if the volume of the body is greater than 4, it has to contain a lattice point. You guys ever heard this fact before? This is Minkowski's convex body theorem. So, and this has, like, really big applications in algebraic number theory. Something that Keenan is totally likes a lot. And something I really like, too. Except I'm not very good at. Okay? Yeah, so Minkowski's theorem is a very, very cool theorem.
Can you restate it?
Yeah, I will. I will eventually. I will state this theorem now. Yeah, so let's see. So Minkowski's convex body theorem. So let K be a convex body. I call it a symmetric body, right? I probably should have named it a convex body. Whatever. In Rn. So if the volume of K is bigger than 2 to the n, then K contains a non-zero lattice point. A lattice point is going to be a point in the integer lattice, so I'll just call it n in the integer lattice. And n is not the origin. So this is a very general theorem. So it says that all I have to do is, you know, a symmetric body like this can be really, really interesting. It can be extremely eccentric, right? So if you start off with, like, the unit ball here, and you try to apply a linear transformation that says something like this, you know, one of the eigenvalues would be just, like, bam, way out there. And then you have another eigenvalue going, like, really, really small and everything. And so, like, the determinant of this thing is, like, very eccentric. So the eccentricity could be crazy. But this says that it doesn't matter. The only thing that really matters for you to have to be able to contain a non-zero lattice point is that you have to have a certain volume. I think because I said I wanted it to be closed, you can actually put equals here. But I'm going to say bigger than because it also gets the point across. But, of course, you can make some kind of continuity argument to bring things to the boundary. Okay. So you guys have any questions before we talk about why this is called the geometry of numbers? Does everyone kind of see? So one of the goals is that we want to just at least try to understand what this theorem says. I think it's kind of simple, but, I mean, I'm kind of used to this stuff. Yeah?
Is there a subscript under volume? What does that say?
So this is the n-dimensional volume.
Oh, okay.
So this is the n-dimensional volume.
Does that matter? Does it take into account the norm that you're using?
No. So this is the Euclidean volume.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's independent of this norm business. Okay. So this is the volume that's like that says that a box with side length 1 has volume 1. Because if I multiply, you know how to find the volume of a box. So you multiply one side by the length of the other side by the length of the other side until you don't have any more sides. You know what I mean? Yeah, so this is the n-dimensional volume. Right. I mean, and, you know, another thing, as long as we're talking about the volume, let's talk about how the volume scales. So in n dimensions, or in one dimension, the volume just scales by, you know, whatever I multiplied by at an absolute value. But in n dimensions, or in two dimensions, if I multiplied everything by 2, then my area gets increased, right, by 4. Right? Because if I take the box of side length 1, so 1 half to 1 half squared, then the volume of this is just 1, right? But if I multiply it by 2, then that becomes side length 2, and then 2 squared is 4. So whenever I take a parameter like this and I multiply it, then this is, it scales to a power of the dimension. So this is the scaling rule for the n-dimensional volume. Okay? So this may not be something everyone's seen, but it's not, you know, this is not too good for math club. This is a good thing for math club. Okay, so now let's talk about why this is a theorem in the geometry of numbers. So to kind of talk about that, are you guys okay if I erase the definition of these bodies over here? Okay. So I want to talk about an algebraic number field. And part of the reason why I'm going to talk about, well, besides motivating what it is, the geometry of numbers, but why algebraic number fields? And the answer is that this reminds me of an algebraic number field. Okay? So algebraic number fields are kind of like vector spaces. And they have something, they have an integer lattice inside of them. So you guys may remember this. So I guess this is kind of, I'll say, like examples from algebraic number theory. So if I take a polynomial with entries that are rational, and this is, maybe I'll do an, x to the n. And if these are rational numbers, then roots of this polynomial are called algebraic numbers. Is everyone, is this new to anybody? So I didn't know this probably until in recent years. So don't be, you shouldn't be feel like you don't know this or something.
I don't know the definition of an algebraic number.
This is the definition.
Well, until now.
Yeah. I hope you now know. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, but and if the coefficients are rationals. No. What's the other word? Integers. Yeah. So the coefficient. No, I forgot how to spell coefficient. So I'll just do an abbreviation, and then are integers. Well, if I think too hard, then I don't have enough power in the short term. Do you know what I mean? So if the coefficients are integers, and these things are called algebraic integers, then we call them. Then the roots are called algebraic integers. All right. Am I doing okay so far? Okay, thank you. So, okay.
Are you saying that roots will be integers?
No. This is just what we're going to call them. What's up? I need it to be monic?
Yeah, that's very important.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, duh. Sorry. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Does that like include everything other than a transcendental number?
Yeah, isn't that the definition of transcendental? Is anything that's not algebraic?
Algebraic.
I think so, yeah. So, you know, there's this theorem of math. I don't know what the theorem is going to. It's this theorem of math that says that this has n complex roots. So algebraic numbers are a subset of the complex numbers. Okay? And so I have n roots of this equation. So let's let the roots be given by this. And I'm going to suppose that this is the, you know, that there's no other polynomial with a root. Or I can't make a smaller polynomial so that this is the root. Okay? It's a minimal polynomial. And these roots are the conjugates, the field conjugates for this thing. And I can make a set, which is called the algebraic number field generated by this thing. And it's going to be F, which is the points and the complex numbers, but I'm just going to write it this way. So they're going to be things I could write of the form, I don't know how to do this. Maybe I'll choose the letter B. Okay, so B plus B1, and then plus B2 squared. And then this could be B to the, I'll do K. And I'll do this thing, K, where K is integer, positive or non-negative. And then I could choose these Bs, B1 to BK, to be rational numbers. And this is an algebraic number field generated by that. And this is actually, so this is what it is. And this is actually a vector space over Q of dimension n. Just kind of like a situation we have over here. You know, we have a vector space, and it's dimension n over R, except we have a little bit different situation over here. And there are actual algebraic integers inside of this thing that form a lattice kind of like this does. Okay? So then we're kind of starting to see something here. Okay? So this is a vector space of dimension. So how much time do I have? Okay. Of dimension n. And I'm going to write n equals r plus 2s. Okay? Oh, Mike, why are you writing r plus 2s? Okay. Well, r is going to stand for the number of real embeddings for this field, and s is going to stand for the number of complex embeddings. And so I think that, Keenan, you're going to have to help me with this one. But I think that it depends on r is how many of these are real, and s is how many complex conjugate pairs you have of these. Okay? And so that's just an easy way to see. So the word real embedding, I don't even have to talk about that right now. Okay? It's just how many of these are actually real and how many are not. Okay? So S stands for how many complex conjugate pairs there are of those things, of those field conjugates. Okay? Okay, so now, Mike, now you've kind of been babbling about algebraic numbers for a little while, but you're not connecting this up with this. Okay, so I better do that or else I've failed. So if I take a bunch of points, maybe y1 through yn, inside of my algebraic number field, then I can make something called the discriminant. And so it's this number, y1 through yn, given by the determinant of y j, then I. This right? I do the transpose. Well, actually, the transpose of the determinant is the same thing as the term of the transpose, so I shouldn't care about the i's and j's, should I? Oh, geez, I should have just left this the way it was. Okay. So, and then these are the field conjugates for the yi's. So here, this is just means field conjugate. Of course, this doesn't matter tons for our discussion. So if it's not making sense, that's okay. But the idea is that the determinant... Oh, wait. Let me back up. Determinant. I see determinant, and I think geometry. Why? Does anyone know why I would think geometry when I see determinant?
Volume.
So what is the determinant measure the volume of?
The change in the volume of the, like where it takes it to be a cube, I guess.
Right, yeah. So So if like I have a linear transformation actually on a unit cube, then the Jacobian of that linear transformation actually tells me what the volume at the parallelotope is, right? But another way of saying that is that if I have a determinant of a matrix and I make a parallelotope using the columns of the matrix as the endpoints, then the volume of that creature is the determinant. And that creature is a symmetric body, right? So the idea is here, and of course I'm glossing over this, but here we're going to, you know, there's a symmetric body in the background. Somewhere, right? It's lost. It wants someone to come find it, but we're not going to do it today. And the idea is that you could connect this up with symmetric bodies and volumes, okay? But the thing is that this is just the discriminant of these numbers. So there are algebraic integers in F that form a basis. For, well, the algebraic integers in F, but I think that this is also true. Kenan, you're going to have to help me. But for F over Q. I think that this is right. Okay, very good. Just kind of like, you know, when I had the integer lattice, I take the standard unit vectors, right? So this is akin to E1 and EN, which are actual integer vectors in Rn. So I have like an analogy of these standard basis vectors in Rn, but for F over Q. Okay? And the discriminant of the field of F is actually equal to, I'll just say discriminant of F, I'll do sub F here, is actually equal to the discriminant of these algebraic integers. And so this would kind of correspond to this situation here. So that you have, there's some symmetric body someplace, and there's some volume measurement going on. And I'm actually interested in when the symmetric body actually contains, you know, this configuration of integer points. So here's a corollary. So using this kind of setup, there's a lot I didn't tell you because it would just take me forever to tell it to you. But here's a corollary of Minkowski's theorem. So if F is the algebraic number field we're talking about of degree R plus 2S, and D, so then here's the theorem. You get a lower bound on the discriminant of F. So the absolute value of the discriminant is has this lower bound. Pi divided by 4 to the S power, then n to the nth power over n factorial, all squared, I think. Right. Is there anything that should have told you that the discriminant of the number field is always bounded below by this? No. If you're studying discriminants on your own at first, you'd say, I don't know what the discriminant is. I have no idea what's going on. But Minkowski's theorem actually tells you that the discriminant is always bounded below by this quantity, and this quantity is actually always bigger than 1. Just like this stuff with this discriminant, you would never, at least I would never suspect, since I'm not good at this kind of thing, that the discriminant is actually bounded below by 1 for any algebraic number field. So this is a very non-trivial application of Minkowski's convex body theorem. So you guys remember at first we were talking about like geometry, right? We were talking about like, you know, putting these little really thin sets in the plane and trying to get them to miss a lattice point somehow, right? And then I said this is Minkowski's convex body theorem. This is one of the fundamental theorems in the geometry of numbers. But at this point we hadn't said anything about numbers, right? So we talked about, you know, if I'm big enough and I have an integer point. But, you know, integer points are very special. And, you know, here you actually see a number theory application of Minkowski's theorem, which is pretty cool. So, yeah, you have a question?
Yeah, I think I have something. Is the discriminant of F not depend on your choice of a basis?
That's an excellent question, and it does not. I should have mentioned that. Yeah. And that's it's a good exercise that I've never done. So you might try it sometime and let me know how it goes. Yeah.
It's because the only invertible elements of the integers are 1 and minus 1.
Duh. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I've never done it before. Yeah, it doesn't depend on your choice. Yeah. So I remember this. I don't know why, but I do remember this. But Keenan, he's told us why. Yeah. Okay. So I don't have that much time left. I have like 20 minutes left. I think that's enough time to prove Minkowski's theorem. You guys have any questions before we start on that? It's really cool. It's Fourier analysis proof of something that seems very geometric. Okay. So, let's see. Maybe I should restate the theorem so I don't have to erase it when I get over there. Okay, so Minkowski's theorem. No. Okay, so K is a convex symmetric set with those other properties that we talked about, but I'm just noting again that these are the main ones. In Rn, and so the volume, so I'm just doing some shorthand now, so if the volume is bigger than 2 to the n, then there is an integer point n not 0 such that n is inside of k. So now we want to prove this. So we are going to use Fourier series. So those of you who know Fourier series are going to love this. Those of you who don't, I don't know what to do. I think I'll probably make a remark or something. Okay. So the only thing that we're actually going to have to use that's non-trivial is Parseval's formula. If we have enough time at the end, I'll show you how to do that. It's pretty easy, but it's the only kind of non-trivial thing. So I'm going to let P be this. Is everyone okay with this? This is the box in Rn that everyone's saying yes, so I'm going to go on. So this is some kind of cell. Actually, I want to close off this interval there like that. And I'm going to define the characteristic function. So I don't know if you guys have seen characteristic functions before, so I'm going to define it, of k half. So this is going to be 1 if xi is an element of half k. So half k is just I've dilated everything. I've dilated the set by a half. And that's actually where I'm going to get this 2n, because remember the scaling I was talking to you about? Okay, so foreshadowing. Okay? And 0 otherwise. So this is called the characteristic function of half k. Okay? Now I'm going to do something, some trick that people in Fourier analysis and number theory do constantly, and that's called we're going to make it periodic. We're going to periodize it. Sometimes it's called the periodization of this characteristic function. So I'm going to let phi of xi equal the sum over all lattice points in Zn of this thing evaluated here, but I also translate it like this. This is actually a periodic function now. And periodic with respect to these points. So if I took a point m in the integer lattice, then what I do over here is I have n and zn like this, m plus n, but then I could just take a change of variables over here, but adding, you know, a lattice point to this lattice is going to keep it the same, so this is actually going to equal this. So this is a periodic function, and it has a fundamental domain. It has a domain. No. It has a domain P. So this is the fundamental domain for phi. Okay? So let's see what we have here. So now I'm going to define some Fourier coefficients. So the Fourier coefficients are going to be given by. So for anyone who has not seen Fourier series before, you probably need this definition. So I'm going to integrate over p, and I'm going to look at e to the minus 2 pi I. So k is a vector here. K dot product with xi phi xi times dot this. So what this is, anyone knows this formula that, you know, cosine plus I sine thing? Yeah, same thing here. And what we actually have, what this does, so what the Fourier series really tell you is that how much of this kind of frequency are inside of this function. So you may not have seen this many times, but this is kind of another inner product. So that's not exactly what's going on here. But this really says that, you know, an inner product tells you how much of one vector is inside of another. And that's what's happening here. This is saying how much of this frequency is inside of this function. And so that's what the hat of k tells you, that this is how much the frequency is inside of it. So that's just my little remark about Fourier series. But one really cool thing about Fourier series is that we have some really nice formula, Parseval's formula. That's the one we're going to take advantage of today. So we have this formula. This is Parseval's. And it goes like this. Integrate the square of phi. You know, I think I have enough time to maybe sketch out the proof of Parseval's formula. This is actually equal to the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients. Maybe k is a weird choice because I have a k for my convex body. So this is Parseval's formula. So I don't know if a lot of you guys know much complex analysis, but this is how this goes. If you write this out, what's another way of writing phi? It's this. Sorry, this is just a sketch, okay? And then, so how do I write this? Well, actually, I didn't tell you, but we can write a Fourier series for this. So e to the 2 pi I m dot this. Okay, so if you believe that what's inside here is actually equal to this, then I can square things out. And what's squaring things out? Well, it's taking this, and so something in absolute value squared when it's a complex number is the thing times its complex conjugate. And then times e to the 2 pi I m this. And then I could do a double sum, m and m. Now, maybe I should play by the rules and not skip too many steps. Complex conjugate. But this complex conjugate I could put here. And since I have this complex number here, put the complex conjugate there. Multiplying these out, I can move the sums. These are sums. I'm going to formally move them on the outside. M and M. And what I'm left with, well, also these don't depend on the thing I'm integrating out, right? So this is phi M, phi N. And what I'm left with here is P, and then I have e to the 2 pi I M minus N dot product with this. And you can check that this is actually going to be 0 if those things aren't equal. So if this thing is 0 when they're not equal, that means the non-diagonal terms cancel, and I'm left with the squares. And it's actually equal to 1 otherwise, so I'm left with the squares. Pretty fancy, huh? So I get my Parseval's identity. I'm going to erase it, unless someone else has any questions. Stuff like this you do all the time in my office. So if you guys want to, like, you know, you guys like this, and you say, like, maybe he has another thing where he expands out a trig polynomial or something, and, like, I do this a lot, so. Okay, so let's erase this. But anyway, at least you have some kind of idea about why this works, and it's not too hard. So I have this, but now check this out. Okay? When I look at this at 0, I'm really taking this. This is e to the 0 times this, right? So that's just the integral of this. But if I expand this out, this is the sum over m of this characteristic function plus m like this. And though, so I can change variables and move this like there. And I can move this sum on the outside. And then since these things tile Rn, then I could just really replace this with Rn. And this is Rn of the characteristic function like this. And I think that this is the volume of what this is the characteristic function of, and that is 1/2 k. So I will write that just like I was taught to do long ago when I was a boy. Plus the non-zero ones, right? No. Okay. Right? Because all I've done is I've taken out the 0 one, and I replaced the 0 one with this volume. Okay? Okay, now we're really working. We're really going. We're having fun. This is good. Okay. Okay. So now's the magic. Okay? Now you guys get to see the magic. This is good. So, suppose K does not contain a lattice point. Contain a lattice point. Okay? So then, so I'm going to say something, but you're going to be confused for a second, then we're going to resolve it. And then you won't be confused afterwards. Okay? So then, if I look at a 1/2 k plus u and a 1/2 k plus b, this is empty if u, v, and the integer lattice are not equal. So what I've done is I said that if I take 1/2 of k, you know, this is like 1/2 of k, and I move it to have center at u, and I look at k translated by v, I really want them to be off of each other. Okay? So I'm saying that if k does not contain a lattice point, then this is true. Is that when I translate 1/2 k by u and 1/2 k by v, they don't intersect. So why is that true? Well, suppose that k did have, or suppose that this did have an intersection. Then I could write, so suppose they had an intersection. Suppose the point was x. X is inside of this intersection. So this means that x is inside of this and x is inside of that. So then I have a point k1 and a point k2 in 1/2 k. Or I could write that as I have a point k1 and k2 in k such that a 1/2 k1 plus u is equal to x, but x is also equal to a 1/2 k2 plus v, where k1 and k2 are inside of k. Okay, so now I'm going to say, I don't care about x anymore. So I've said it. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to move things over. So I'm going to have a 1/2 k1 minus, or plus a 1/2 minus k2 equals v minus u. So I've moved this over here, but instead of writing minus k2, I put the minus right next to k2. This is also in k, because k is symmetric. So this is in k, this is in k, and isn't this a convex combination of k's? So isn't this also in k? Oh, wait, but this is a lattice point, right? Okay. So now I have this. So now I'm going to erase the explanation. Okay, so what's this mean? Oh, wait a second. If I squared out this thing in terms of this, products of these things are going to run into each other. So I'm going to write out this squared is going to equal what? Well, it's going to be sum over m of chi of xi plus m. And I'm going to multiply it by n xi plus n. Oh, man. Now these things are going to run into each other. I have no idea what's happening. Do I? Do I? Oh, wait a second. But if m and n are not equal, then this is only 1 if this is inside of the translation of these half k's translated by the integers. So they're going to vanish unless I'm on the diagonal when n equals m. Oh, my gosh. Oh, no way. Awesome. It's awesome. Wait a second. Whoa. So this periodization is actually equal to its square. And what did I say over here? I said that this was equal to this thing over here. So what do I have now? So now I have to make up my mind, don't I? What to erase and what not to erase. Okay. So this implies that when I integrate over p, this thing over here on the left-hand side of the Parseval identity, I really have the integral over this. And this is the point where I think this is cool. So this is the left-hand side over there. It's equal to this. And if I put an e to the 0 here, then this is the 0th Fourier coefficient. And this was volume n of half k. So now let's plug this into the formula over there. So the left-hand side is volume n of half k. This side over here, oh, wait a second. Wasn't I supposed to have this absolute value squared? Sorry. Right. I have to keep it squared. It's a big no-no to not have things squared when you're supposed to. So then this is going to give me volume n half k squared plus the other terms. But remember this rule I told you about earlier? That this is equal to, if I scale this out, this is 1 half to the nth power times the volume of k. So now I want to multiply both sides like this. So multiply both sides by, so I want to make this 2, if I want to make this 2 to the n, then I need to multiply both sides by 2 to the n squared times the volume, or the inverse of the volume. Right? So then I go 2 times 2 to the n. Wait, another way of writing that's just 4 to the n, isn't it? Because of simple arithmetic, right? It's a theorem of math that this is also 4 to the n. Okay, divided by volume n k. So if I multiply both sides like this, then what do I get? Well, I'll just tell you. How about that? 2 to the n equals, well, let's see. One of the volumes here is going to cancel. And I'm going to have 2 to the, so this is going to give me a half. Oh, okay, I'll just do it. So then here I'm going to have 4 to the n divided by volume n k times what's going to happen here. This is going to be a half to the n times volume n k. And then this is squared, right? I can move the square over here. And then I can move the square over here. So I'm going to get one volume left. And this 4 is going to cancel with that 4. So I'm left with volume here. Good sign. Plus this constant. So what's this constant? I'm going to call this constant C. C times positive numbers. Right? Ah, wait a second. I think I'm done. Because if I have a positive, oh, well, it doesn't matter. I have the volume plus positive numbers is equal to this, right? So if I subtracted off this thing, then this side would be smaller because it's positive, right? So that means that 2 to the n is bigger than or equal to volume of k. Grand finale. Yeah. All right, so you guys have any questions? All right, I didn't go over my time, did I?
No.
All right, well, thank you guys very much. It's been fun. Yeah.